From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 737, Azure IaaS Management with guest Samuel Erskine. Recorded Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Samuel Erskine, who is a cloud solutions architect and author focused on cloud technologies with a core competency in Microsoft Azure. And Samuel is the content designer and lead author for 4 Microsoft System Center cookbooks and the co-author of 2 System Center Unleashed books. He's also the Microsoft MVP and a regular speaker at community user groups and conferences worldwide. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me on the show, Richard.
I love that you've done all these System Center books, and this is the first time on the show. I'm vaguely embarrassed, sir. We've been making this show for a long time. System Center has been a regular topic. I swear I have your books on the shelf, and I've never had you on the show before, so I apologize.
That's no problem at all. You can think about me as, you know, the advisor in the background. I'd like being an enabler versus being front and center. So it's a pleasure. Most of the books I've been involved in have been collaborative books as well. It is a shared thing. Some of the cookbooks were my design all up, but it took others contributing to make it as successful as they were.
Well, and System Center is such a broad suite. Like, no one person has any of those products in their head, really. Not even, you know, Johan Arvidmark. Like, it's just too much stuff.
I do agree. And even within one particular piece, so, you know, one of the System Center products, Config Manager, that worked with since SMS 2003, there were people that specialized in just the operating system deployment aspect of it. So it just goes to show how broad and deep.
Yeah. And my time was with Operations Manager because I was always a web performance guy, right? And we were always instrumenting and watching what was going on. And it was one of those things where every time you scratched a little deeper, there was more.
Indeed.
But I don't know that. Well, I guess SCCM and OM play a role in sort of managing VMs, whether they're on-premises or on the cloud, right? Like, they don't have to, but I think it's a fairly normal thing to do.
I do agree. And I'm also a great believer in the objective, not the tool. As you've mentioned, they do manage those operating systems. However, you always have to look at the circumstances. So for instance, I wouldn't roll out, you know, any of those tools in a small surgery or something where they've got about 5 computers. It's quicker to go around them, patch them manually or monitor them than to try and put these in. So it's always about appropriating the objective-driven side as well.
Yeah, but you hit this point where you're now dreading the next patch run because it's so many machines. And you're going to make mistakes. And it's like, you know, there are tools for this.
Very true.
I really appreciated this blog series you did about Azure. I mean, really VM management, but infrastructure as a service as a whole. Because I see this happen where folks are migrating to cloud and they worked really hard to organize their VM on premises. And then something happens when they toss them up into Azure and it just seems to turn into a pile of goo.
Indeed. And you know, when I wrote the blog series, it's because I was working in a team that delivered patch management. And when we looked at what it will be like to manage those VMs in the cloud with all of the requirements like firewalls, etc., my mindset was, well, the patch is already in the cloud. It's got something that you can use to deploy it. So the core question is, how do I get compliant and how do I show compliance rather than which tool I use?
Yeah. And so, I mean, that always begs the question, like, what do you mean by compliance? Because that's a very somewhat subjective term.
It is. And it's usually driven by your organization, right? So we deal with risk and relevance. So what I mean by risk and relevance is that if a particular patch is deemed to reduce a certain risk, but it's not relevant to you, then you don't need to be compliant to it. However, if, you know, I'll use something like SQL. If it's a SQL patch that's come out, it's very important. But if you don't have any SQL service, you don't need to show compliance to that. So that's the level at which I deal with compliance. And you know, also some organizations do decide that once a patch is out, it's got to be deployed within 2 weeks or within a month. So those are all very relevant when you're planning what that little word means that can spark a lot of debate.
Well, plus, is you know, if you're moving that quickly on a patch, it's like, what's your testing strategy too? Because I know plenty of folks who's like, no, I'm going to be the last guy to install that patch. I want everybody else to figure out what the problems are with it, not me.
You know, in about a decade ago, I would have probably gone with that same principle. Those were the days where it was very much like, you know, what was it, the odd service packs or the dangerous ones. but now, once a patch is released, it means that the vulnerability, even if other hackers didn't know about it, now they know about it. Because it's very much like the gold rush, right? The minute people know about it, everybody's going to be there. So it's really more about your disaster recovery, IT continuity, and how best you've designed your systems to cope with the perceived downtime that you can get with a bad patch. So it's really more about how am I set up to recover should this go wrong, rather than I'm going to wait till I find out what's gone wrong everywhere else before I go.
Yeah, really having a working rollback strategy you're not afraid to use.
Indeed. And, you know, sometimes people are like, well, we back up. Well, the question we usually ask is, have you ever tried to restore it? And how long is it going to take you?
And what are you missing? You know, your classic, there's an Active Directory interaction here and rolling back doesn't clean up the AD stuff. So is it still going to function correctly? Like, it's only a working strategy if you can and have done a restore.
Yes. And, you know, I've learned that sometimes it's quicker to rebuild. That's how I got into book writing in the first place, because I document a lot. And there are times when you'll come across a scenario where trying to restore a system, especially if the data is held somewhere else, you might be better off just reinstalling it based on how it was supposed to be configured, because trying to undo some of the mess that you can have could end up costing you time, money, and a whole lot of stuff that wouldn't add any value.
You're also dealing with, you know, probably a machine in a fairly unknown state. It's like, okay, I got it back up, but I can't tell you exactly why. What I do like about the rebuild strategy is that you hopefully are automating the set of steps to make that server over again, which is far more reproducible in a known state.
I couldn't agree more, Richard. And, you know, it's the reason why, you know, I got into technology in the days when you didn't have Google. You had to phone a friend. And if your friend didn't know, then, you know, you spent at least, you know, 4 days trying to troubleshoot an issue. But once you knew it, it glued into your head. So we got very used to documenting steps and trying to automate repeatable tasks. The technology has gotten better, but the principles haven't changed.
No, but certainly our ability to communicate with each other, to get support now, you know, or that server fault or docs. And once upon a time, it was ICQ and CompuServe too, right?
Yeah.
Or is it in the Windows Unleashed books? Like, maybe it's there, or your books. So that's how we used to have to find stuff. Now it's not the way we sort. That's not how we solve problems at all. Although I realize I have rubber ducked in messaging apps since ICQ. That just, you know, you always have someone on the other end of the line that you're typing to. Whether they know what you're talking about or not, really, at least they can empathize. But most of the time, writing it out is all it takes to really break the problem down.
Indeed. And, you know, the funny story about documentation is, you know, even my own blog posts, there are times when I figured something out, I just can't remember, you know, a year down the line when you ask me. So I go back to my own blog post and reference it. Say, oh, yeah, actually, that's what I did. So they've ended up being my little online documentation tools.
Or you Google for a solution to a problem and you find your own blog post as the best answer in the Google.
Yes.
That's a good day, too.
Well.
All right. I want to circle back on this a little bit because we're talking about organizing, but maybe we're in the midst of a migration. So we're pushing VMs from on-prem up into Azure. And any given application set's going to have a bunch of them. Like, obviously, the update strategy is important. Like, how are we going to maintain these? But how do you sort of group them up in a way that allows you to see these are the things related to that set of application?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I loved about getting into new environments is my opportunity to rethink how I organize. Mm-hmm. And in traditionally, we'd have used naming conventions.
Yes.
But given that, you know, we're now in an environment where you can use tags to actually label things in a way in which it's not, challenging and painful, like a naming convention where, you know, right. You can't rename a server without other implications. So yeah. I will say tagging definitely is one of the things that I loved about trying to start off when you're organizing yourself within Azure.
And so you could have multiple tags. Do you really tag it by like the application it supports? Like, what's your strategy for tagging?
Well, it's same strategy as you do with naming convention, right? So In the early days, people were calling servers Homer, Bart, and whatever TV show was on at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It just didn't scale. So the strategy for tagging is really, you know, thinking about things like environments. If you're going to use it to support compliance or something else, just calling out what will be a common framework rather than simply what I need today. An example, when I look at patch management, we will typically patch in phases. And, you know, do I need to reboot the machine? So can I set a tag that tells me reboot allowed, yes or no?
Right.
And, you know, the environment. So is it dev, pre-production, et cetera? So
I love that of putting a reboot tag on, right? Or like reboot caution.
Yes.
Just to remind yourself, you should look at this machine a bit more. There's a reason why we're careful with reboots on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, interleaves with how tags can also be applied, right? So you can use policy to dynamically apply a tag based on how you've organized yourself using, say, management groups within Azure itself. So it's not just how you tag, but you can also automate that and then leverage that in grouping so you can use it. So I would say if anybody is going to look at that, just take a step back, very much like how we use naming conventions to really organize ourselves in traditional on-prem scenarios. So, you know, you can append numbers to it and, you know, a certain number range belongs to something else.
Right. No, this is the same old taxonomy problems we've always had. It looks like Azure's given us a few more tools to make it a bit easier.
Indeed. And not only that, being able to, you know, rewrite those tags, it's similar to when we went into app virtualization on the desktop side, where you decoupled all of the registry pain points from the actual operating system. So tags allow you to sort of like decouple some of these settings that were typically buried in the registry. And were detrimental to expose them to a level where you can use it as a search in your queries just to find out where your assets are, or you can use them to sort of like, you know, do your systems management or whatever else you want to do.
Do you also change tags on a machine based on things that happen to it? Like, I can imagine having a tag that is, this is a testing server. And then if you needed to promote it to production, you would just change the tag.
Absolutely. That's the value of it, right? So
yeah, it beats the heck out of putting that in your server name and then needing to change the server name.
Indeed. Right. So, I mean, I experimented initially with, before you had what was known as dynamic groups within Azure, I was actually setting a registry key specific to be used for patch compliance.
Right.
But it just meant that, you know, I now had a different challenge where if I needed to change something, I had to be careful with how I changed it in the registry. So being able to actually leverage native tags, it abstracts that pain point and reduces your risk profile.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And Sam, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. This episode of Run As is brought to you by the new Virtual Dev Intersection and SQL Intersection Workshop event. If you've ever listened to the SQL Q&A shows on Run As, you've heard the fun knowledge and experience of some of the workshop leaders at SQL Intersection. And for the first time ever, the event is going virtual December 9th and 10th. Go to virtual.devintersection.com to register and check out the amazing lineup of workshops. And there will be great keynotes from Scott Guthrie and Charles Manana, and the workshops cover topics including Azure, .NET development, as well as SQL Server-related materials. Spend a few hours and go deep on important topics at virtual.devintersection.com. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Samuel Erskine. And we're talking a bit about, well, virtual machine management, IaaS management in Azure, and keeping things orderly. What do you end up naming servers in this scenario? Knowing that you don't need to do the names to do identification per se, like prod or pre-prod or anything like that. That's all in tags now. What do you end up in it as a server name?
Well, I still follow a naming convention, right? So when you use your ARM deployments and templates, right, you can define place that, you know, uses a range. So I still use, dev, PP, or prod. But then you can make the latter part of it more dynamic by just getting it to append a series of numbers to it. So, or you can decide on how you're also going to prepare the different subscriptions that you're going to use. So
it,
you still have that flexibility. However, you don't have most of the big challenges that you had on-prem. Because most of these things, they're software-defined deployments. So if you had to rebuild another server or reuse a name, you're no longer searching for somebody's, Excel spreadsheet or,
Word doc.
Word doc or something. So at least you can query and know whether a name is in use or not.
Yeah. And actually, the script is the truth. Because it's what you're about to make.
Indeed. And I suppose what I can add is because somebody will say, well, why would you need to name it? Simple answer is we are human and we are visual. So, for instance, I've got country tag, so GB and then D for, Great Britain dev. So if I'm in a multinational organization, then having something that defines the location in your name would do it. But you just want to literally keep the parts that are unique, very simple and appropriate. And then the bits that you don't care about, like, the number sequence, those can repeat.
Sure. But at least I guess it's got to be, you got to make a decision about, do you ever reuse a server name? My instinct would be no. Once a name's used once, never use it again.
Not necessarily, because, once you're using your tagging principles and your resource groups, et cetera, right? It's I would say it's like, you're called Richard, but I don't think if, you ban the use of the name Richard, you're going to change much in the world, right? It's just, you are tagged by your social insurance number in the US, right? And we've got a national insurance number. So
it's social security number here in Canada.
Oh, there you go. Right. So almost made a cardinal mistake there trying to compare a Canadian to an American.
That's fun. It's like all you Europeans are the same.
Indeed, sir. So, yes, you don't want to reuse a server name, but if you do have to, so long as you're dealing in an environment that you expect that behavior anyway, you're good.
It's not that big of a deal. Then is the whole side of automating the creation of a set of VMs for a server update or new version of the app, that kind of thing, which, I mean, heck, we've done whole shows on that. Do you have some particular talking points around how you tackle that problem managing VMs?
Yes. I mean, a good friend of mine, Steve Buchanan, has done some good blog posts on, you know, sort of like, you know, using, for instance, using blueprints to prepare your environment. And then, like, you know, the ARM templates being embedded into things like Terraform and others. So the automation of building it, you want to make sure you plan for that, do some testing, and then get into the tools that allow you to build it. But you want to remove that human interaction.
Sure. And I think the tagging has got to be automated into it too then, right? That
yes,
should be part of any creation of a VM, is that nobody has to go back and tag it. It's been tagged.
It's been tagged. And all of this is through the policy. So typically the way we look to plan the environment is like you build it, leverage your management groups, and then assign sort of like, you know, your tagging policy to it. So as soon as the machine is built, if it's dropped into that particular management group, it will be tagged appropriately and you don't need to worry about it. So, you know, I do the same thing with role-based access control. So that I have a group for, say, update management admins. So they get added automatically to have the rights to be able to manage those virtual machines.
Yeah.
So then all you're doing is similar to what we will do is ensuring that you manage the group that people belong to rather than going to each machine to see if, well, did they do that on this particular build or not? So automate as much as possible.
Well, and this is the important part of it. You know, we all love the idea of servers as cattle rather than servers as pets, right? But that also means you have to have all the automation around your RBACs and ACLs and so forth, because you're always making new machines. It's just a normal part of the flow. And if it doesn't get included in all the security groups, well, you know, now you've got servers nobody can manage. Yeah, interesting sort of reality of all of these pieces. But I also hear in your descriptions, you're always going to end up with some pets and some cattle. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree. And it's just knowing that you have them. It's the most important thing, right? Because it's when people don't know, that's when they can mistake one for the other.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a tag, pet or cattle.
Yeah.
Is this a server I know I can rebuild on demand, or is this one you need to take care of?
Yeah.
Is it special?
And, you know, I'm a big fan of Gene Kim, you know, things like the Phoenix Project. And I recently read The Goal by, I think the author's name ends with Goldratt. But it's when you go back to actually stripping everything down and making sure you build it right and then run it right, it reduces the need for this pet cattle problem anyway. So
right. But I mean, there's an implication here. Is often we have this conversation where it's like, well, how do I manage my VMs well? And the pushback is, you shouldn't have VMs. It should all be platform based, which is lovely. It just doesn't seem like reality. We always seem to have a VM somewhere.
It is the goal, right? It's a bit like the speed and limit, right? It's not a target. Right. So ideally, we all want to be in the past world.
Yeah.
However, we still have a lot of things that are not ready for that yet.
And yeah.
We have to live in a realistic side. And I do believe that, you know, several years ago, if you'd said we were going to be predominantly working remotely, most people would have laughed at you and said,
yeah,
you know, they'll be watching TV and drinking tea all day.
Yeah, no. And then suddenly we all had to do it, and somehow we're still getting work done.
Exactly. So, you know, the era of past will come, but it's going to take a transition, and there will always be a need for virtual machines, very much like the people that prefer to still play games on a PC that they've built themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not I own consoles, but that's not where I go to play. I still play on my PC. You know, maybe I'm just old.
No, my favorite is solitaire. You know,
that comes from a voice of someone who's flipped discs for days.
It relaxes you. It's a different kind of meditation.
Yeah, a little distraction while you're doing the thing that needs periodic attention. You know, that's very, very true. Monitoring VMs, getting them plugged into the different monitoring suites and organized and so forth. Are we talking operations manager, or is it all analytics these days, like the Azure products? Where do you fall on that?
Well, I've sort of like, you know, pivoted and moved away a little bit. But where I fall in this, like I said, you know, I look at more governance and compliance. However, you know, I've always been a big fan of update management. So most of the new features that I've looked into are built around the automation account. But I think this week they've got Ignite or something. So I'm sure there'll be some announcements that will make this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're recording this just like as Ignite is about to start. So everything we said could be incorrect now. Goodness knows. You know.
Exactly. And, you know, Richard, this is why when I agreed to have this conversation, I was excited about us talking about the principles, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been focused around the transition into using update management in the cloud, but then also the governance pieces that help businesses to gain confidence in whatever cloud provider, because you don't want the wild, wild west out there. Where the context is to do with virtual machines with full operating systems, patching is still one of those frontiers, right? Because you can't stick firewalls in front of everything and prevent everybody from getting to it.
Yeah, constant challenge in that respect. And the tooling is not even the important part here. There's always going to be new tools and better tools.
Yeah.
But are you tackling this in a way that's ultimately sustainable, even as you evolve too? It still seems like we're in the area of migration, certainly during the pandemic, where you're picking up existing workloads and shifting them up. But it feels to me like that's the least valuable thing you can do in the cloud is run a set of VMs. Like the real value comes when you start using these actual cloud services.
Indeed. And, you know, you do have some hybrids, right? So some organizations require that you have a jump server. I know you've now got bastion hosts, et cetera, right? But you still have the principle of, you know, they want you to go and hop. So you're going to have a small set of infrastructure components that still have that dependency. Mm-hmm. And it's best to, prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Type. And then the only way you can do this to really go in and explore. And my guidance around this is don't jump into this by going to, your GitHubs, et cetera, and go and grab scripts. Walk through it first, you know, using the portals, because if you haven't walked through it, you don't know the value of the automation. I've typically blogged from a zero mentality, because if you've never seen it and experienced it, you will never understand the script that you've just gone to grab that could end up being worse for you. So it's, you know, the copy paste modify doesn't always work.
Yeah, the server fault model, right? Taking everyone else's scripts. Although there's almost no excuse for writing PowerShell from scratch anymore, right? Somebody's written something close to what you need. I guarantee it. Go learn. Grab what's available.
I do agree. And, you know, I always grab somebody else's script as a starting point because there's no need in reinventing it. However, it's always best to understand why they wrote it.
Yeah.
And then translate it to your specific scenario so you don't have adverse effects.
Yeah. People writing good generic scripting like that, it's complicated. It takes time to really read those more complex fault-tolerant scripts.
Indeed. And those scripts as well. Remember that somebody walked into somebody's office virtually or, you know, in person and said, I've got this problem. I need you to fix it. And my question is always, do you have the same problem?
Yeah. Yeah. Or if you know, maybe you do have the same problem, but you haven't fully realized it as much as they did in this script.
Yeah.
All that additional complexity. Adjacent to this whole conversation is that script management side. What strategies do you take on for source code management and maintaining versions that everybody have access to when you're working in a team? Do you have particular tools you like for those?
Well, I work with teams that have those tools. I mean, mm-hmm. we go way back to things like Visual Source Save, but I do know right. that, you know, now with the pipelines, etc., right? Mm-hmm. It's all about actually following a standard set of those tool set appropriate to your organization rather than yeah. which one you are using. And it should always be a system that allows you to check in and check out code instead of ones that people can, you know, keep copies and right. iterate around there. So definitely version control and making sure that you have strict testing processes in place so you don't have any regression.
Yeah, testing ARM templates, testing deployment runbooks and so forth, they're not, generally you run them to just put them into creating instances that you're not going to depend on. Like I don't know that we have truly like simulated testing so much as you actually just exercise the cloud to do it. The testing harnesses aren't like they are in dev, for example.
No, and you know, even within those environments, right, they've automated mm-hmm. testing itself. And you have, you know, I'm not going to use develop so many years ago. I don't do it as much now because, you know, there are people that do it better. They're much
oh,
younger.
Oh, much, yeah.
But
I don't think I'd pay for the code that I can write. Goodness knows.
Exactly. But, you know, they typically make sure that whatever they're doing, they have things like, you know, I'm going to get basic here, right? So things right. like PowerShell with what ifs, et cetera, right? You mm-hmm. have different ways of actually validating without breaking, yeah. even from a starting point. And then when you look into some of the, you know, cloud functions as well, you know, when you look at things like change tracking within Azure, it can tell you what's changed. Right.
Yeah.
So you've got very, very quick feedback loops that you can use that allow you to instill some best practices in everything that you do.
Excellent. Yeah, I really appreciate that thinking. It's good stuff. So where can folks learn more about you, Samuel, and the stuff that you're working on?
So I'm on Twitter at Sam Erskine, but mm-hmm. I'm also kicking off a new initiative called Africa Talks Tech, which is to open the window into Africa because it's currently got the largest young population over there. And
yeah.
it's way ahead. You know, when I watch certain movies where they portray different countries,
yeah.
That's like 30, 40 years out of date. I'm not a big fan. So that's
this sounds like a whole other show we should do, Sam.
Yeah.
This is a good topic. Yeah, let's circle back on that. I like that a lot. If folks want to hear it, you know, more at the Africa Tech, let me know. We'll make a show about it because I think it's a huge topic and really an under-tapped resource.
I do agree. And, you know, it's not bragging if you can back it up, but if you really do need to find me, you can Google me.
That's true enough. And there'll be links in the show notes as well. Samuel, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Richard, for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.